Thank you all for coming out early in the morning, beautiful Phoenix morning. And this also want to thank the Society for giving me this tremendous honor. Niall and I were colleagues in the last few decades of his life, and I know many of you were colleagues in earlier decades. I want to spend a little time today talking about Niall. Some of the things have already been said about him. And then talking a little bit about his vision for soil science and how I think that can guide us all. Niall has a long, long list of roles that he played. He worked his way up at Cornell University as a professor and department chair and assistant dean. But he's probably best known for leadership positions not only at Cornell but internationally. He was director general at the Rice Institute in the Philippines. And then he also worked as a scientific advisor in USAID in the Reagan administration. He worked with the World Bank. He certainly worked with the Society, being president of the Society, and stayed very active over many years. So he was a terrific contributor and a true giant who we unfortunately lost. But he was at the ripe old age of 95, and until his late 80s, he was coming every year to these meetings. I look back at his research. He's probably known much more for his leadership and administration and education efforts than his research, but some of his research has a rather topical ring today. If you look at some of the topics, cover crops and physical properties, sounds like something you might publish today, Harold. And I know I was just in Africa in Malawi a few months ago, and I saw some of the practices he pioneered being practiced, as they still are throughout the South, in growing peanuts and applying calcium to the potting zone. This was something he developed, and he also worked with early minimum tillage. So in some ways, he was ahead of his time. But it was really as a leader that Niall shined. And his first international major leadership position, in which he really shone, was as the director general, third director general of the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines. And this was a time in the height of the Cold War when China, the major player, the biggest country in Asia, of course, and a huge player in all things rice, was very much closed to the outside world. And Niall reached out and led a delegation of scientists from Erie. He felt it was very important to bring the Chinese Agricultural Research Institute into collaboration with all the other national organizations, and he led this group to China in 1976, just a couple of years after ping pong diplomacy and a visit by Nixon had opened China up at least a crack. That's Niall in the center there, looking very dapper as he always did, very well dressed gentleman, but also a tremendous leader who knew how to empower people so that they took ownership of programs and really contributed their best. I just wanted to mention over there to the left, I don't know if SK is in the audience, but SK Dadada has also come to these meetings. I haven't seen him this year, but he's the dapper gentleman over to the left of that. So Niall was many things. He was the kind of person, the kind of strong spokesperson for soil science, for the relationship between soil science and other sciences. So much of what Harold was talking about and what we've been struggling with, Niall was very much putting into the foreground decades ago. He was president many decades ago and served for almost three quarters of a century. He was the kind of person that people went to for advice, personal advice, advice in administration, how to run programs, and he always had some wisdom to give out. I found this to be terrifically useful. He used to tell me how to teach a class. He said, you know, Ray, the way you teach a class is first you tell them what you're going to tell them, and then you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. And that was his philosophy of teaching. And if you look at the textbook, it's kind of structured that way. I remember collecting lots of stories on advice, and he would basically, his advice in trying to run a program was, you want people to feel that the ideas are their own. Don't try to take credit for things. Let the people under you take the credit. Let them feel it's their ideas. Give them ownership, and they'll run with it. And sometimes he'd give very prosaic advice. I know Pedro Sanchez mentioned that when Pedro Sanchez, who I don't think is here today, but another giant of soil science, when he was the director general of another of the international centers in Kenya, the ICRAF Center on Agroforestry, he was building a new campus and he asked Nal for advice on how he should organize it. Nal said, well, whatever size you made the parking lot, double it. And that was good advice too. I've been there and you can barely find a spot, so it's a good thing he said that. And of course, those of you that knew Nal, he was always a very dapper gentleman. I met him as a teaching, when I was a teaching assistant, a grad student. I was trying to write a supplement for his textbook. My advisor was one of his students. And I remember being very impressed with how well-dressed the gentleman was. And in those days, these meetings were much more formal. Everybody wore sort of suits and ties. You know, I feel like I'm still wearing my Halloween costume right now, except for the hat. The hat's the normal thing that I have. But Nal was so impeccably dressed, and he always was the best-dressed gentleman in the room. I think you can kind of tell from these pictures. Well, when I started the room with him, when we wrote the book together, and we would come to the meetings, and once a year we would share a hotel room, I found that the secret to his success in that area was that his wife packed the suitcase. And usually was brand new. He would open the packages for his new shirt, his new tie, it was all carefully matching. So one has to have the secrets. And the society was just a tremendous part of Nile's life for three quarters of a century, really. He led through almost the founding of it and the leadership all the way through. And so it was a great honor for him, and I'm very glad that this lectureship series was established during the years when he was still attending. So Nal was able to go to the first half dozen of the Brady lectures, and he really appreciated this, and especially the idea of the frontiers of soil science. This is after the first lecture. But what Nal confided in me, despite all of the very high-level leadership positions that he had, official positions, when he traveled the world and talked to people, what he was really best known for was people say, oh, Dr. Nal, not the Brady, or the author of the textbook that first introduced me to soil science. This is a shelf in my office in the basement of H.J. Patterson Hall in Maryland. That's just showing part of the shelf. I think I have the whole collection. Friends have donated books to me when they find an old copy in a used bookstore. So the textbook goes back to 1909. There was a predecessor book called Soils, Their Nature and Properties. And this was always a Cornell book. And Nal co-authored all those editions that you should see there starting in 1952 when Harry O. Buckman asked him to be a co-author. The first author of that was Littleton Lyon, who was the founder of the Agronomy Society and later helped found the Soil Science Society. So the book has a storied history, and I'm sure you're looking at that shelf, many of you can see the book, the version that introduced you to soil science. I know for me it was the black one about the sixth one over. It was Buckman and Brady in the 60s, and then as a TA I taught out of the brown one. And where the books get taller, that's kind of where I started being a co-author. No, the publisher decided on the size. So one of Nal's visions that you see throughout the book, and I hope I continue that, my big fear when Nal asked me to continue this, to writing of this storied classic textbook, was that I would destroy it. You know, a half century or more of tradition that I would get it, it would be a big flop and that would be the end of it. But fortunately that hasn't happened. It's continued to be used all over the world. And part of that vision was the very integrated nature of our science, that we are dealing with this wonderfully fascinating complex system that has all these different aspects. And yes, we need to specialize, we need to drill deep into areas, but on the other hand, we need to understand the context, because no part is independent of another. You can't study soil physics, really, without understanding soil biology, or it has no meaning in the system. You can't study biology without chemistry. You can't look at one part without at least a broad understanding of how they all fit together. And this is one of the things you'll notice when you read the textbook, for instance, that Nal started and that I've continued, is every chapter will have 10 or 20 or 30 references, cross-references to other chapters and other sections, because you have to relate all these things. You can't do it in isolation. And as a result, you can really study it from one end to the other. I know some instructors start at the back and go forward and that type of thing. There's really no one way to do this, but it is important to have this background. So Niall was very excited in his later decades as the century turned and soils took on more and more challenges, and I think the frontiers expanded. It's probably why they called this lecture series by this name. He was very excited to see this role of soils expand and to be active still during the beginning of what is sometimes known as the soils renaissance. There's already been reference to some of these events that really brought soil science into the public eye. Again, like Harold said, in a way that hasn't been done since the 1930s and the Dust Bowl. One of the first really big events was the one that the Society worked on for many years and worked with the Smithsonian to create this great exhibit in Washington, which had about a 4 or 5 year run, I think. It was a great event down on the mall in the nation's capital, and it's still touring in a reduced form to smaller museums around the country. That was followed pretty quickly by some commercial movies, feature-length movies on soil. Well, this one was on dirt, but I'm not going to be too concerned about the semantics. This was followed by a second one on Symphony of Soil, which is a beautifully done movie. If you just want to sit and enjoy homage to soil, this is a good one. And of course, it's being followed now by another one that the Society is putting together. The scientific journals, the very top line global journals like Science and like Nature, have both featured whole editions on soils as the final frontier. And of course, we have first the year of soils, and as I understand it, the United Nations has designated this as the decade of soils. So we have a nice window to move forward with this. And we're creeping into the popular culture. Definitely my favorite scene in any Hollywood movie. If you haven't seen this, it's worth going out and streaming the DVD, getting the DVD or streaming it, just to look at the scene of capillary movement of water through the Martian soil. Matt Damon does a great job with that. So there's a lot of evidence that we really are taking off as a discipline and that our importance is being recognized. I did some Google searches year by year and came up with the total number of papers that had either soil or soils in the title, and you can see it's pretty much an exponential rise during the 2000s. I'm not entirely positive what happened there in the last couple of years. I wasn't too excited to see that trend. I'm hoping it's just a blip, but it's a pretty big blip. We'll see what that means. You can see some of the milestones along the way. This has also been reflected in citations to the Brady Weil textbook, which used to be cited fairly infrequently, maybe 50 times a year or so, but lately has been cited over 1,000 times in scientific publications. And there's also, I'm afraid, a little bit of a blip there in the last year, so we don't know where that's going. On a personal level, if I look at students that are coming to our profession and taking our subject, we know that membership in our society has been going up over the past few years, but it's been pretty steady. It really hasn't shown, hasn't reflected this exponential rise in the number of publications. And this is a bit of a frustration. This is one of the things this is telling us is that there are a lot of people studying soils, doing work in soils that aren't necessarily part of our family here in our organization, but that also in many cases means they haven't really got the background in soils, that they're a specialist that happen to be using soil samples or focusing their efforts on some soil system. So there's been more of a roller coaster ride in the enrollment in my introductory soils class. I still teach introductory soils. I love doing it. I wouldn't give it up. It's one of the things that keeps me from retiring, and I think it's one of the best things that you can do. It's been a tremendous benefit to me personally in my research. It works together very well, and you can see that the enrollments have gone up and down. In fact, I was first hired primarily at the university was a new position because of this overwhelming number of people taking introductory soils. They needed to have someone just to teach that. As soon as I got there, of course, it took 3 or 4 years to go through the process of getting the position and hiring. As soon as I got there, the numbers started plummeting. I got all the blame for it, by the way. I don't remember getting the credit when they started coming back up again, but I do remember getting blamed for being too tough on the students and chasing them away. But I think this is a global trend. In fact, it looked like that line was headed to zero, so we were pretty worried. Maybe some of you remember those days. This was reflected elsewhere. So I've thought about this and experienced it over time, and I really think there's something that has to do with the sort of the national and even global somewhat environmental policy environment. Definitely there was a huge surge in the 70s due to the birth of the environmental movement, which was a grassroots movement, coupled with the GI Bill, which enabled record numbers of people to go to the university. But it gives you some pause for thought, especially the day before an election. I'll leave it at that. Another trend that I've personally observed is I know professors and even teaching assistants are always complaining, oh, students these days, you know, they can't write a whole sentence to save their life, they can't do the simplest calculations, they're getting worse. And you know, I haven't seen that at all. It's a perennial complaint. I think it's a complaint. I think you're getting old when you start complaining about young people. What I've noticed is that students are actually getting better and better. This is my experience. I don't think it's just at the University of Maryland. My students are, I think soil are attracting the best and the brightest, more perhaps than they did in the past. And I think our students are coming in better prepared, knowing more about nature and how the world works, and having better quantitative skills than ever before. One reason I say that is lately I've been asking my students at the end of a lecture occasionally just to jot down the sort of a couple of most interesting things they learned in the lecture. I think that's a good teaching technique to sort of to actively refresh that. And I sometimes ask them to just do it on a scrap of paper and hand it in, because I like to read, you know, out of all the things we talk about, what did they get? So I'm not sure that 20 years ago I would have gotten notes like this. Awesome calculations was not something that they used to say, and I get this now all the time. So you really are interested in a lot of things that may be a little more technical. But not everybody sees, you know, a bright future for our science. We have this conflict between more and more soils work being done and maybe fewer soil scientists actually doing it. This is a conundrum. These are some opinions that were published on the International Union of Soil Science website. That there's little future for soils, at least by itself as a discipline, and that strong soil science departments are gone forever. Well, I beg to differ. There still are a few out there, but this is how it looks. But on the other hand, the Ecosystem Services Millennium Assessment provides a really excellent framework into which soils could fit. Soils are increasingly recognized as being central to the way terrestrial ecosystems work, and so soil components are being involved in all kinds of studies, and I think that's a good thing. Anything having to do with the critical zone of the Earth's surface environments. And our own Diane Wall, who might be here, probably not, soil scientist and microbiologist from Colorado, suggests that soil science has to move forward by integrating many of the other disciplines. We need to branch out, and we should be including them in us, perhaps rather than being subsumed in some of them. So the experience of teaching a general course in soils, a survey course in soils, means, and those of you that teach that, you'll know what I'm talking about, you have to really, in order to teach a subject, even the TAs understand that, you get a knowledge of it and a feeling for it that goes beyond studying it. And teaching is such a general course means you start to see all the interconnections that you might not consider otherwise. So this soils being such an integrated system, there's never been a year that I've taught soils, and certainly since I've been working on the nature and properties of soils, which is a broad textbook, kind of used both as a textbook and a reference, that it hasn't informed and sharpened my perspectives on other people's research, on soils research, and on my own research. So we have all of these sub-disciplines and all these areas which we have to specialize in and learn all the techniques and drill deep into them, but we need to recognize that all of these areas are caught up in an entire web of interrelationships. You could probably give several examples of processes for every one of those arrows going in both directions. So there's a tremendous interrelationship there that you can't really pull the pieces out. They don't They don't stand on their own, even though we need to look at them sometimes separately. Just as a quick example, I'll give a few examples, since Harold's sitting in front of me, of the effect of physics on microbiology. So there are many gene jockeys and microbiologists, we were just talking around the table, that are, you know, drilling into molecular techniques that happen to be working on soil samples, but may not really see the whole picture of how that fits into the system. So we'll take a look at an example. Let's consider soil water. Get into lecture mode here. You know that there are a number of different models, mental models, of looking at the relationship between the amount of water in soil and how tightly that water is held or how it behaves in soil systems. And so one of these is the thickness of the water film, you know, so that the wet soils have thicker films, the loose, more loosely held water in these films gets thinner as the soil is dry. Another one focuses on pore size, and what size pore is holding the capillary water. And then an interesting model has to do with the angularity of many of these pores and the fact that even within a pore size, the water can retreat into the corners as the soil dries. So let's consider how this perspective of understanding of soil physics impacts biology as a seemingly unrelated area. Let's consider the importance, for instance, in evolution and competition of motility. If you're a bacteriophore nematode, it's a great advantage to be able to hunt down those, move from colony to colony when you're grazing and swim through these water films and these water-filled pores. But that advantage may disappear as the soil dries beyond a certain point and these water-filled pores become isolated and the motility no longer gives an advantage. You can see how that physics will inform your biological ecological theory. Another simple error that I often see microbiology studies stumbling over when I review papers, especially, you often see microbiologists that either don't understand or forgot some of the basics of soil physics. For instance, if you're doing an incubation study in which you're trying to look at the rate of respiration and the breakdown of different materials, and you start out with a controlled soil, maybe a sand, maybe glass beads. So you have a control soil and you have some mixtures, maybe with compost, maybe with biochar, different kinds of materials that you're looking at the degradation of. And you're setting up this incubation and you have 100 grams of dry equivalent of each of these soil mixes, and then you add 20 mils of water to each one, and now you think you've treated them all alike, right? Of course, this sandy soil with 20% water may be nearly saturated. And there may be oxygen limitations. The one with the compost in it may absorb more water, and the 20% may actually be near field capacity. It may be more ideal conditions. And then maybe the biochar really absorbs a lot of water, and has maybe negative 65 kilopascals or something thereabout, and it's actually pretty dry. And what you're looking at then is, of course, the microbial response to moisture differences, even though you thought you had them the same, and not necessarily the substrates that they're growing on. Really common kind of mistake that happens when the big picture is lost. So we have a lot of, each of our sub-disciplines is undergoing kind of a revolution. It's a really exciting time to be in soil science. But again, we need to be communicating with each other because these new insights are happening in different parts, every place from pedology to physics to biology to plant physiology. And of course, we can't know everything, but we do need to communicate. One of the great things about coming together, and maybe one of the arguments about staying with societies that look at some of the other aspects that Harold was talking about. So I think you're familiar with some of these. So one good example of that is how the soil chemists were working along for really a couple of decades before they really started to communicate with the soil ecologists and the plant people and the people working in other areas of soils to communicate some of these changes in our knowledge of soil organic matter. So the new edition of the textbook, I worked quite a while on this diagram and bounced it off of a number of scientists in this area. It's quite different from your grandfather's story of soil humus being formed and sort of stabilizing through this complexity of giant macromolecules of humic substances, which turn out to be kind of boxing in shadows, so that they weren't really there. Another thing that we've learned in recent years is that you can't really pull out these parts what is soil without plants? Yes, we'd like to study soils on Mars, but is it really soil? We need to acknowledge the intimate relationship between plants and their role in the formation of soils and in the functioning of soils as being part and parcel of soils, just like organisms living in soils are part and parcel of soils. And then it's difficult to talk about plants, even though a plant physiologist may do everything in solution culture or even excise cells. But the plant in its native habitat isn't just a plant. The plant is coated with communities of microorganisms, which are then interacting with the rest of the soil. So there's actually starting to blur boundaries. The idea of the rhizosphere is being developed now, so we have different rhizospheres and different impacts going on. And this expanding definition is actually blurring the boundary between what is a plant and what is soil, or even between one plant and another. I found this study to be kind of interesting. This was a study, a face study, which is free air, enhanced elevated CO2 study, where they used carbon-13 depleted CO2 in a really big, must have been a very expensive study with forest trees, with the, you can see the tubes, these are emitting the trace gas into the atmosphere around the canopy of this forest so that some of the trees had depleted atmospheres. And they did this for 5 years, and then they started looking at that carbon, tracing the carbon through the system. And amazingly, what they found was that in the fine root structure, the active root structure of the trees, that 40%, almost half of the carbon in the trees was carbon that had not been fixed by that tree. It had been transferred from other trees, sometimes other species, not even related. So these were spruces and beeches and larch trees and pines. And 40% was due to tree-to-tree transfer even between species, largely mediated by microorganisms and mycorrhizal interactions. So we're talking about a very complex system, and to try to look, pull out one piece of it without understanding that background, without bringing people into our society, and without having people actually go through introductory soil science courses where they get that big picture, is a dangerous weakness. And I come across examples of this all the time, of things that are misunderstood. Another area in which we see this integration playing out in a really revolutionary way is in the agricultural sector, particularly, I think, in North America. I think we haven't seen this kind of change in farmer thinking probably again in almost a century. So as scientists have changed their focus, so have farmers. And for the first time that I can remember, and I think going back from before the Dust Bowl, farmers are thinking beyond horsepower and herbicides and starting to think of the health of the soil system. This is becoming mainstream in agriculture, and it's actually one of the best kept secrets in agriculture that's just now starting to get out into general public knowledge. Cover crops are turning out to be an enormously powerful tool for managing soil health, and farmers are getting very excited about this. So we're entering an age at which our science is going to be able to participate in this new kind of collaborative management of earth systems. We see it here in Phoenix. We see the need for it here in Phoenix. I was on a tour yesterday in which we both saw this kind of collaboration, and we also saw the need for much more of it, where we had people working on, say, water without understanding soil and that kind of thing. So this is where I think where we're headed, and I think if we go there, I know that Niall would be really happy to see that happening. So thank you so much, and have a great meeting. Thank you.
On behalf of the Soil Science Stadium, I'd like to thank Ray for a wonderful presentation that really encapsulates Dr. Brady, but it brings the real meaning of soil science back to us. So thank you very much. Great. Thank you very much.